Hi there, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Fuel Your Phantom podcast. My name is Saint.
I'm Jim.
How's it going, Sleepy Jim?
Oh my gosh, it's been a week. I'll tell you, it's been a real week. It's been a very enervating week on top of a series of other enervating weeks. We've taken the piss out of me plenty for being, Captain Seven Jobs.
That's so fucking lazy. You're a lazy fucker.
And it just really hit a fever pitch this week with some people in my department on vacation, with some freelance projects that were due, with the band trying to get ready for a big gig we have this weekend, plus the regular trivia stuff. And it's just, and just some other things that are going on that really are things that I probably shouldn't talk about. Just, it's been really, really a ringing out sort of week in terms of time, health, emotion. And I'm kind of on my last nerve. I'm just irritable as shit. But you know what? I'm here and I'm committed to doing the thing, because this here podcast is one of those things that doesn't feel like work at all. I look forward to this all week, every week, and getting to sit down with my boy and chew the fat over some pop culture shit. That's a respite from all the things I have to do. I get to do this. I don't have to do this. How are you?
Well, I'm glad that it's something you look forward to. It's, again, something I look forward to as well. So, man, I don't know where to even begin. More health shit. Yeah. I don't know if we're ready to talk about that yet. But we always talk about old men bitching about their health. And so that's kind of how I'll introduce this.
Time to sit and listen to two old guys bitching about their health. Hey, so please indulge me while I whine and feel sorry for myself.
I've been dealing with my diabetic issues again this week. Anybody who's out there who is type 2 diabetic, type 1 diabetic, whatever your flavor in particular, I myself am type 2 diabetic. I've been having really, really good luck with medication as far as bringing down my A1C. However, the problem is the insulin has been causing a massive weight gain on my part. Like, I've gained in the last year, no shit, like 80 pounds. And that is not okay for me. I am dangerously heavier than I was when I started this, which is weird because normally people who see an A1C drop would see the weight loss that coincides with that. And it's not that I'm overeating, because I'm not. It's not that I'm eating a ton of sugar, because I'm not. It's all due to the insulin causing fat storage, from what my nurse was telling me. So,
man, the delicate balance of the endocrine system is the biggest argument against intelligent design I think I've heard in all of philosophy.
It's just a mess. I mean, it's a fucking juggling act. And it's like, so yes, on the one hand, I had talked to my doctor like a month and a half ago, and she said, okay, we're going to up your dose on the Victoza, which is the medication that's kind of akin to Ozempic and all that. And we're going to up your dosage on that to the maximum dose on that to see how your stomach handles it. If your stomach handles it well and you're still not losing weight after a month or so, shoot me a message and we'll push to get you on the Ozempic instead. And so that's what I did, as I went and weighed myself the other day. Haven't lost any weight. Haven't gained any weight, but I'm still at the heaviest I've been in a decade or more. Two decades. Since my first divorce, I would say. And, so that's not okay for me. And, it's like all those people who are just bitching about the fact that, I'm doing something healthy and it's having negative results. It's having backwards results. So I emailed the doctor, and one of her care team responded back. And I get that they can't respond to all the emails personally. I get that. They're busy. Probably understaffed and underpaid and whatever else. But
just like all of us are.
Right. And so the care team got back to me and said, hey, it looks like you're in target range with the Victoza, so we're not going to push for a move to Ozempic because there's a nationwide shortage of it, and we're just not sure we can get that approved.
Don't I know it? I mean, Mounjaro is the one that I'm on for most of my maintenance, and they're having the same shortages with that too. I'm in several groups on like Reddit and Facebook where they talk about, hey, are you able to actually get your medication this month? And a lot of people aren't.
Well, yeah, and so I got pissed because I'm like, look, this is not a conversation we need to have. We've already done this. I said, it wasn't because of the A1C numbers. I understand my A1C numbers are in range and in good looking shape. This was about the fact that I have not lost any weight, and I have supposed to have been losing weight. So there's now this disconnect there. And I said, so I said, why don't you just please pass my message on to my doctor, who I sent this to, who knows what I'm referring to, and we'll go from there. And so I got a message back from my doctor this morning, thankfully, saying she's going to push for the Ozempic. We'll see if we can get prior authorization in and move to that. So I'm not sure when that'll happen, but it's a fucking Herculean effect to get anything accomplished with your healthcare these days. And it's really frustrating when you're trying to do the right thing. Like, and another thing is I had a conversation with my diabetic nurse about the fact that apparently my body's become somewhat insulin resistant over the fact of that I've been using the insulin over the last year. And that happens. But what happens when you're insulin resistant is you have to increase your dose to get the same effect. Same kinda thing like with heroin use. Yeah, exactly.
If it's something you stick in your body with a needle, your body eventually is like, yeah, I've pretty much had enough of this. Give me more of that.
Right, more of the same, but better. And so it's not having the same effect, and so you have to take more and more, which, of course, is not healthy, especially as it revolves around the weight gain. And I said, look, I'm getting really super frustrated over the fact that I've done nothing but... And she's like, well, have you talked about going to a nutritionist and seeing and altering what you eat? I'm like, I can't alter what I eat anymore.
Yeah.
I said, the one thing I never wanted to change about my lifestyle was I was okay to give up smoking. I gave up most of my drinking. I gave up almost all of the bad habits. I didn't want to cut everything I loved out of my life. And so it's like, yes, I don't eat as much candy anymore at all, well, by
far. Are you still heading out under the overpass to murder bums on weekends as stress relief? Because that's one of those things that I know was you absolutely treasured that for many, many years.
I can't get rid of that. I can't get rid of that. That's
no.
That's a step too
far. That's therapy.
Oh boy, here I go killing again.
That is.
Right.
No, but it's as ever, like being in your 40s and being a Western person who has to deal with the Western diet and all of the non-food the FDA approves and all the shitty lack of nutrition, processed fast food on the shelf, prefab bullshit. Growing up trying to keep Tamagotchis alive was good practice for trying to be somebody who the stupid animal you're trying to keep alive in your 40s is yourself.
Yeah, well, and it's dumb. And I said, look, I can't cut out much more. Like, I know I used to eat a load of candy. Yeah. Like, we're talking bags of candy every day while I was driving. I have maybe 3 or 4 Jolly Ranchers total over the course of a day now.
Yeah.
As far as, like, snack cakes and Little Debbie's and this, that, and the other thing, I'll have maybe a granola bar. And if I'm feeling froggish, I'll have one of those little apple hand pies, which I know are horrible and they spike the shit out of me, but you know, as opposed to what I used to eat, that's so much better. I said, but I'll tell you what, I am not going to do kale smoothies. I am not going to do fucking brown rice. I can't stand brown rice. I can't stand quinoa.
I like quinoa. I like brown rice. I like wild rice. And that's the thing.
I don't like the texture. I can't get past it.
Or not my nutritionist, my diabetic educator told me that I needed to, and it's really counterintuitive because when you're a diabetic, your carbs are kind of your enemy. Anything that turns into sugar in your body, whether you're eating sugar outright or whether you're eating carbs that turn into sugar in your body, you're led to believe that's the enemy for both diabetic, you know, blood control and also weight loss. But so I had been eating like a package of cold cuts for lunch. No bread, just the cold cuts. Just like 8 or 16 ounces of cold cuts, depending on how hungry I was. And for the morning, I was having like a 60 calories worth of almond milk blended with 65 calories worth, or 60, not 65 grams of protein between the protein powder and the yogurt I put in there. And she's telling me that, you need to have some carbs, bro, because your brain runs on sugar. So, again, it's like, it really is like an RPG where you have a certain amount of points you have to allocate across a couple of different areas. And putting them in one bucket takes them out of the other, and you wind up kind of walking out of the door in the morning really unbalanced and not really sure what the fuck you're trying to accomplish. So, yeah, I sympathize.
I wish I really God do. I could just see my fucking stat bar That way I could cue myself in as a, what am I missing here?
What am I missing? What am I deficient in? What do I have too much of? But no, we have to walk around with these fucking blood sugar things in our arms. We got to go and do lab tests, and we got to go to our doctors and make copays and Fuck being alive for the most part. I mean, I'm a big fan of it, but, you know, just trying to maintain being alive. Yeah. I mean, that's just the health thing. That's not even talking about, like, food or money or sleep or any of that other shit that we have to do in the given day. You know, I heard once that if your body was a used car, you wouldn't fucking buy it. But you mean, oh, so I got to fuel this up 3 times a day whether I go anywhere or not? I mean, I got to wash this thing every day? It's going to depreciate the older I get, and I'm not going to be able to trade it in? Fuck this noise. I'm not making any payments on that. That's a really crappy deal.
It's definitely a no for me, dog.
And, yeah, that's a, it's here a, we are. A trite observation, but it's not wrong.
Right. So, yeah, the struggle goes on. Yeah. There's certain foods that I won't eat. There's certain foods that I will not substitute. Like, my wife, I love my wife to death. She tries so hard to take good care of me, which is seemingly counterintuitive to what I do for myself, which is not true, but it feels that way sometimes. She made me some sugar-free brownies with, like, a Splenda substitute or something like that the other day. They're not good. I couldn't eat them. And I feel bad about not being able to eat them. But, like, the texture's weird and crumbly, and it's the same thing whenever I've tried to eat, like, the sugar-free cookie that they sell at the store. The texture's off. It's crumbly. It's weird. It doesn't bind together right. And it just doesn't taste good.
Yeah. That's the insidious thing about sugar, is that sugar's not just a sweetener. Sugar's also a chemical agent, and it's necessary for certain kinds of baking. It holds things together. It crystallizes. It turns into a syrup in some cases. It is, you know, cooking.
It's a binder.
As you know, you're somebody who spent a lot of time cooking. It's a passion of yours. Cooking is kind of, you follow your heart. If the recipe calls for 2 cloves of garlic, you can use 12. If it requires a little bit of the salt, you put in some extra salt. You adjust things on the fly depending on your tastes and where your heart is. But baking is science. Baking is chemistry. Mm-hmm. If you're even a little bit off on the ratio of some of your ingredients, that cake or that pan of brownies or that cookie is just going to be inedible fucking sludge. And boy, if you're trying to live a sugar-free lifestyle, it's never more clear that that there's chemical things that happen when you have sugar versus when you don't.
That is a fact, Jack. But I'm trying, and like I said, bless your heart for trying to help me with that. We'll get there eventually, but hopefully the medication change will make a positive effect. I'm trying to stay positive. I got real down and negative on the phone with my nurse yesterday, but it's just like to the point where it's like, look, I need to vet this to somebody.
Yeah.
And they've assigned you. So you get to hear it. And I had to tell her because she sounded like she was starting to take it personal. Like, and I'm like, okay, look, I need you to take a step back here. And I need you to understand something. This isn't my interaction with you. This is my interaction medically over this whole thing. So don't be like, oh, if you want to speak to someone else, we can make and arrange that. It's like, no, you just need to understand where I'm coming from so we can start fresh and hit a different level. So I'm positive that that's going to happen. It's just a matter of figuring that win out. So.
Well, continuing a little bit with the sort of the grinds my gears nature, the bitching here at the top of the show, I've been struggling a little bit. With, like, we did an episode on AI, and we did it quite a while ago. Since then, there have been so many leaps and bounds in what AI can do. You put those clips of the Suno AI-generated songs up in last week's episode. We talked about how I feel kind of threatened by the fact that I write for a living and have for almost 3 decades, and AI is proving to be not perfect, but good enough for a lot of people's purposes. And now, Facebook, which, again, like, you and I bitch a lot about Facebook because there's a lot about Facebook to bitch about. And
it's
I understand that Facebook is a service. It's a thing we get for free. We use it because we elect to use it. But in many ways, it's also kind of insinuated itself into our lives in ways that it becomes very hard to extricate. I have a lot of very far-flung friends based on having had a lot of hobbies, having moved around the country a lot, having been involved with a lot of groups, and this is like the only place where they're all in the same place. So for right now, the convenience of Facebook is still outweighing the negative aspects of it. But There's two things about Facebook, just since the last time we complained about it, that are really pissing me off. First and foremost, Meta AI. If you've used Facebook, especially mobile Facebook at all, in the last maybe 2 weeks, they took away your magnifying glass in the toolbar and put in a little rainbow AI circle. And, yeah, if you hit that, it still gives you the opportunity to search for things, but you kind of have to wait a second because it wants you to interact with the AI. Like, if I'm searching for a friend so that I can send them a message, or if I'm looking for an event that I signed up to attend that I need to make sure that I know what this... If I'm searching for anything on Facebook, there are a lot of reasons why I'd search for those things that don't involve me having to interact with fucking Meta's AI. I have to use AI enough in my daily life in an occupational sense that I don't want to have to do it during my leisure time too, but Facebook put up this fucking AI thing, and... Maybe that's a break, a divide between the olds and the young people, because I have a lot of friends who are in my relative age group in the general sort of Gen X bucket and there on up, who are just like, come on, Facebook, nobody fucking asked for this. AI does not have to crawl into every crevice in the universe. We don't have to have this in every aspect of our lives. Just give me back the fucking search bar. That's what I use. I don't use the AI. Give me that shit back. But that's kind of a secondary concern.
I tried fucking with that AI the other day, and I didn't like it. It didn't answer the questions in any of the ways.
It's
that
the
I
no good.
It to, and, yeah.
You know, exactly. And so there's the search bar thing, which is really galling, and that's a pain in the ass. That's a functionality issue. It's getting in the way. But the other thing that's really pissing me off is the last maybe month or two, Meta has decided to incorporate not just the AI tools, but also this end to end encryption on on the Messenger. Now, I understand the need for this. In an ever-evolving world, the need for cybersecurity, the sanctity of data, so that people can't, you know, snipe in and grab shit. It makes sense. I get it. But what this thing has done is your messages no longer accurately sync across platforms. So I could be talking to you. I could be talking to somebody on Messenger on my phone. And then if I am out on the road or something, if I'm out in the world, or even just out in the kitchen and I'm talking on the phone, I'll come back in here and I'll put my phone on the cradle to charge and I'll put the phone down. But then the message will pop up again and I think, well, I'll just answer on the desktop as long as I'm sitting in front of the computer. The messages don't sync. Photos don't come through. Media doesn't come through. Links don't come through. You have to go in and open it up in a separate window and then force it to manually refresh. And sometimes even then it doesn't sync up. And then you wind up picking up your phone again. And as anybody who's neurodivergent knows, if you sit down at your computer and you have a window up that you can answer messages in, that's kind of a side thing. That's a tertiary thing. That's something you can have up without having to focus your full attention on it. But if your phone is in your hand, oh, that's the phone. That's you know, there's games on it. There's little other, you know, just all kinds of things you can, you know. We talked about this the other day. Like, there are certain things that are desktop activities and certain things that are phone activities. You're not going to play Angry Birds on the toilet on your desktop. You're just not. And also, like, something as serious as, like, I don't know, buying plane tickets. That's a laptop activity. That's not a phone activity. So even though they're ostensibly kind of the same device, one just being larger and the other being more portable, there are phone activities and there are laptop activities or desktop activities. Computer versus phone. They're two distinctly separate devices, even though there's a good amount of overlap in the Venn diagram of their functions. There are things, right, I want to do on my phone, and there are things I don't want to do on my phone. Same with the laptop or the desktop. And ne'er the twain shall meet. So when I go to answer a message on the laptop and it hasn't synced up, and I'm like, where the fuck did that... I was going to refer to something. There's a phone. What the hell? Then I got to pick up my phone again. It just pisses me off. And again, I absolutely understand. These are first world problems. These things are miraculous devices that keep us connected to the rest of the world, keep us connected to our friends. You and I are sitting in separate states, you know, a good 2,000 miles away having this conversation, and then we're going to upload it to the internet later so other people can listen to it. And that's all miraculous. Don't get me wrong. But these things, we're so used to certain things working and being seamless and being used to the form factor of them, being used to the functionality of them, and then in order to justify their paychecks and continue to grow and generate revenue as a growing concern, people like Mark Zuckerberg and fucking Elon Musk, who will come up again in a minute, feel like they need to just go in and fuck with things and fix shit that isn't broken, and it just absolutely chafes the ever-loving shit out of my ass that they do this, yeah, because it's not necessary. It isn't. It leave it the way it is. And again, I also understand that this very much marks me as an old. Things are bad now. They used to be better, and I don't like the way things are changing. We grew up with technology. We're Gen Xers. Our generation invented the fucking internet, and we were at the forefront of innovation, and we're pretty flexible about rolling with the punches a lot of the time. But these things are egregious. They're unnecessary. They're absolutely things nobody asked for, nobody likes, nobody wants, and nobody's really using, but they feel like they gotta wedge that shit in anyway because, oh, this is Silicon Valley. We're a tech company. We gotta constantly fucking innovate. You know what doesn't innovate? Craigslist. Craigslist has been exactly the same since the goddamn 90s, and I use Craigslist on a fucking weekly basis. It hasn't changed because it still works. There are so few things that are like that, and I really wish there were more of them. But you know what? Facebook is a necessary evil, and we have to keep on using it because it's in many ways the only way we can promote our shows, the only way we can connect with our friends, the only way we can waste time on the toilet because TikTok is going to fucking go away since, you know, Congress voted to ban it.
Unless they divest themselves, which I don't think they're going to be able to do.
There's still some Hail Mary salvos that might happen with that. The ACLU is going to fight that ban on First Amendment grounds, and they've had some success doing that in smaller, similar cases, but this is going to be a big deal and a precedent setter. But nonetheless, I mean, I am enamored by technology, I rely on technology, but I am exhausted by technology. And I just wish there were certain things that could just stay the same for 10 goddamn minutes so I don't have to constantly adapt to new shit.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
Rant over.
End rant. Yeah, I get that. I get that for sure. We have a bit of news, and I gotta quit looking at the internet while we talk because I keep finding more news to talk about. One of the most important things that I can't believe I left out of my initial list was net neutrality has been restored as the FCC votes to regulate the internet providers once again. I cannot possibly overstate how welcome this is. This is from an article by AP News. The Federal Trade Commission Thursday voted to restore net neutrality rules that prevent broadband internet providers such as Comcast and Verizon from favoring some sites and apps over others. You figure that'd be a no fucking brainer, but then it's like the fact that people are like, hey, we want people to go to Facebook only, so all Facebook traffic gets sped up to like 10. Everyone else going other things, they could be at like a 5 or a 6. Yeah. You don't get to make those decisions.
Because Zuck is paying extra to make sure he gets to use the fast lane.
Which is dumb. We don't get a fast pass. Yeah. This isn't Disney World.
Amen.
There's no fast pass. So the measure passed Thursday on a 3-2 vote, split along party lines, with Democratic commissioners in favor and Republicans obviously opposed. Let's see. The move effectively reinstates a net neutrality order that the commission first issued in 2015 during the Obama administration. In 2017, under then-President Donald Trump, the FCC repealed these rules. So we're taking it back, which is nice.
Yeah. It's pretty rare that there's good news, especially on the technology front, especially because I just heard the other day that, I don't remember his name, he's one of these minor Congress critters, but one of the people who was one of the big sponsors of the TikTok ban bought a whole bunch of Meta stock before he pushed that bill through, because Zuck might be one of the people who'd be able to buy in or slash invest in TikTok if it goes south, because God forbid there's a corner of the internet that isn't WhatsApp or Instagram or Facebook or Threads that he fucking owns. He needs to get all of it. Greedy bitch.
Well, so yeah, I figured I'd start with something good news-wise. We got a few other things, but I figured I'd lead with the good news here.
And there's actually a little more good news, too, because there's been some legislation that's passed recently, not necessarily tech-focused, but the government said that non-compete agreements in a professional setting are no longer legal. So if you are working for an employer and they make you sign a non-compete agreement saying you're not going to quit and go work for the competition if they give you a better offer, or that you can't... I mean, obviously, there's still some corporate espionage concerns involved with that, like are you going to steal secrets and then run to the competition, but I remember a while ago, like I have there are some companies that I actively boycott. I don't eat at Chick-fil-A because they actively try to legislate gay people into the status of second-class citizens. I don't shop at Hobby Lobby, not just because I don't decoupage or knit, but also because, you know, they actively lobbied Congress and eventually the Supreme Court to say that they don't have to care about women's health. But Jimmy John's is another place that, even though I really like their sandwiches, I don't eat there anymore, partially because their founder is a big game hunter who likes to mount endangered species on his wall, but also because he had this really, really shitty non-compete agreement. Like, if you're a Jimmy John's employee, you can't bail and go work for Subway, Quiznos, or Jersey Mike's within a certain period of time if he decides to fire you or if you leave, which is kind of crap, because especially in the job market we have now, relevant, applicable experience is one of the only currencies that any potential employee has when trying to petition an employer to hire them. And if, hey, I worked at a sandwich shop and I know how to slap together a goddamn sub in about 11 seconds is not relevant experience if you're trying to transition from one place like that to another, then what would be? So, yeah, non-compete agreements out the window, and that can only be good for the job market and the economy. And boy, do both of them really need that.
Absolutely. Again, like you said, there's corporate espionage issues that do have to take place. And some thought that has to still be put into place with that. But it's like, you work for fucking Jimmy John's and you want to go work for Subway. That's a lateral move, bro. It doesn't matter. The relevant experience matters.
Yeah. Unless you want to go work at Jersey Mike's. That's definitely a step up. There's a Jersey Mike's that opened up about 10 minutes from here. And every week I have to run over to do some banking in the town where it's located. And boy, is it hard not to stop in there and have myself a cheesesteak. I fail that battle a lot of weeks.
What kind of cheesesteak do you get? Incidentally,
I get Jersey the 17, Mike's. The number 17 Jersey Mike's. The Philly cheesesteak, I haven't dumped the peppers out, but I add mushrooms to it.
Get the 99. It's off menu. This is a secret for all you guys who have a Jersey Mike's video.
Tell me
it's
more.
Peppers, mushrooms, onions, it's the cheesesteak and all that stuff, but it's got like a chipotle sauce on it. It is amazeballs. 99, number 99. You'll thank me.
Well, that's good inside intel to have.
All right. Speaking of intel that people shouldn't have.
and espionage.
And espionage, as it turns out. There's been a computer breach out of North Korea that has revealed that some animation may be being farmed out to North Korea, which is a big no-no with our embargoes against sending work to North Korea. I'm reading from an article from CBR.com. In a report by CNN, it's reported that North American researchers found files containing production artwork for popular or upcoming animated programs like Invincible and Iyanu, Child of Wonder, on a computer server located in North Korea. The production artwork appears to be the work of North Korean illustrators and graphic designers, suggesting third-party outsourcing that goes against the strict sanctions enforced by the United States. This is problematic. In the fact that we don't source work out to North Korea, that's a big fat no-no, but the fact that one of my shows that I really enjoy, Invincible, might be not necessarily guilty or a culprit, or they're implicated in this. And this article actually strictly talks about Skybound Entertainment, which owns the rights to Invincible. It's Robert Kirkman's brand, has responded. Skybound Entertainment, the entertainment company co-founded by Invincible co-creator Robert Kirkman, released a statement regarding the CNN report, quote, "We do not work with North Korean companies or any affiliated entities and have no knowledge of any North Korean companies working on our animation," the company said on social media website X. Quote, "Our policies strictly prohibit any subcontracting to any third party without our express prior written consent, which in this case was neither sought nor granted. We also mandate that all of our service providers fully comply with all applicable rules and regulations and prohibit disclosures of materials by our service providers to third parties. Skybound Entertainment takes these allegations seriously and has initiated a thorough internal review to verify and rectify any potential issues. We have also notified the proper authorities and are cooperating with all appropriate bodies."
Now, I'm super weirded out by this.
Yeah.
I'm weirded out by this for a reason that wasn't really discussed in the article that I saw, and that is that I mean, obviously, it's a pretty big no-no to do business with North Korea because they're a country that we don't have any relationship with diplomatically and, in fact, have sanctions against because they're North Korea. And if you need me to explain that to you, then you probably have been living under a rock for the last 40 years. But the thing that gets me about this is that North Korea, very famously, doesn't really have any connection to the outside world, including internet. So, A, I'm wondering how these files got there in the first place in order for, because it looks like they may have worked on these. I'm wondering how those things even landed on that server to begin with, and I'm also wondering how they were found. Because if you've got an island unto itself like North Korea that is pretty much technologically cut off from the rest of the world, how do they have that? And how do we know they have that? That's the part that I'm definitely paying attention about, because it just doesn't make any sense to me based on what I know of their isolation status.
Fortunately, tensions caused by this international incident were resolved by the steady hand of Dennis Rodman, who let Kim Jong-un win in a one-on-one basketball game against him, continuously saying, "Oop, you got me," in a way that was just convincing enough for Kim to believe.
It seems to be a bit shiesty, yeah.
A little bit.
How do they know? Curious.
Curiouser and curiouser.
Riddle me this, Batman.
Lots of unanswered questions. And at the risk of pissing off a pretty significant portion of the people who listen to us that have taken me to task on this, you know as well as anybody who listens that I love to clown on Apple. I'm just not a fan of their company.
Like an Olympic event.
Yeah, it's my maintained position that Apple is a very successful lifestyle and fashion brand with a deeply shitty electronics division. They're just super successful at certain things, but when it comes to actually making functional devices, they definitely have their shortcomings. And you know, I'm not a fan of Mac computers. I'm not a fan of iOS devices. But apparently the world at large is not a fan of the Apple Vision Pro. Now, the Apple Vision Pro is the sort of enhanced reality, virtual reality headset, the ski goggles that you put on your face. Now, these things, whether it's Magic Leap losing their venture capital funding, whether it's the PlayStation VR headset or the Oculus Meta Quest, any of these headsets, kind of strikes me as being the same thing as like with Zuckerberg with the AI. They're just trying to wedge these things into the consumer market, even though most people don't really want them. They certainly have a niche. I mean, I know that you're a big fan of VR gaming, and gaming seems to be sort of the preeminent area where these headsets actually excel and where they're having some success in the marketplace because it's a really good niche for them to occupy. But as far as having this sort of like dive mask on your face, these scuba goggles that you're going to wear around, that you're going to view the world through this lens, people don't fucking want it. This is from MacRumors.com. Apple cuts Vision Pro shipments as demand falls sharply beyond expectations. Apple has dropped the number of Vision Pro units that it plans to ship in 2024, going from an expected 700 to 800,000 units to just 400 to 450,000, which is roughly half. Orders have been scaled back before the Vision Pro has launched in markets outside of the United States, which is a sign that demand in the U.S. has fallen sharply beyond expectations. As a result, Apple is expected to take a conservative view of headset demand when the Vision Pro launches in additional countries. Apple will introduce the Vision Pro in new markets before the June Worldwide Developers Conference, which suggests that we could see it available in additional areas in the next month or so, but Apple is still expecting Vision Pro shipments to decline year over year in 2025 compared to 2024, and the company is said to be reviewing and adjusting its headset product roadmap. Now, to me, these VR headsets that aren't specifically focused on gaming as a function, they're really a solution in search of a problem. I mean, we had Google Glass a number of years ago, which was not the big goggles. It was a little framework that just kind of had a little square of glass in front of your eye that you could project things on. We've had phone apps that you can hold up to the world with your camera open that will show you like hours of restaurants you pointed at or even a translation of a sign if it's in a different language. Things like that are kind of useful, but kind of niche. But this insistence of tech manufacturers to push these expensive, bulky, fucked up looking ski goggle things they expect you to strap to your face and walk around in the world at large with them on, or even like do things at home. There's a certain amount of form following function that exists in all architecture, computer products, even internet applications, where the shape a thing exists in kind of has to coincide or at least follow or be inspired by or informed by whatever activity it's intended to engage in. And, mm-hmm. you know, maybe it's a future thing we're not ready for yet. We have phones. We have laptops. We have devices that we can use to connect to the internet. Nobody's asking for headsets beyond, like, a gaming context. Where they, again, are admittedly doing pretty well. And a lot of the games that are coming out for, like, the Oculus or the PlayStation VR, they're doing fine. And I know you enjoy them. I know I have a lot of friends who do. I actually have dipped my hand into that a little bit. I have a friend who's got a VR headset, and Beat Saber is fun as fuck. I love it. But beyond that, there's just no real application for these things that isn't already being satisfied by something that's simpler, already familiar, and not as expensive. So,
well, and you made mention of Google Glass, and I think is what they're trying yeah. to do is they're trying to find applications that would be an always with you, always on the go, hands-free kind of device, but it's just this isn't the move. It isn't the one yet. Yeah. I think they screwed up by not involving Google Glass more. That was an innovative product for its time. Same yeah. with Microsoft HoloLens, because
yes.
these already emulated glasses. They emulated a piece of attire that we already primarily wear. And to make something so...
Of course it looks big, but did you know it was this big next to a person?
I mean, I get that they want this to do all the things, but
right.
Start small. You know, cell phones didn't always do everything that cell phones do. They started out as making calls, T9 mm-hmm. texts, then eventually moved up to, hey, it's a Palm Pilot. You can store phone numbers in it. You can do this.
You can organize Snake. Your calendar.
Yeah. You know, you got to gradually shift into these other areas. You can't just jump full on going, hey, it's an all day wearable. You just look like a fucking, like you're fighting a Yeti while you wear it. I mean, yeah. It doesn't make any sense. So, yes, they're moving in the right direction. Taking it out of the home right now, I think, is silly. You see people videos of people driving around with them and walking around with them, and then that was mostly for the clout. That was like influencer type shit, which I don't jive with anyways.
Right.
But these are meant for in-the-home use. You're not going to catch me, you know, walking around with my MetaQuest helmet on just because, you know, it looks foolish. I don't even like playing with the damn thing if the window's open. Because I'm pretty sure people looking in my window going, what in the hell is he look? He's like climbing a mountain or he's swinging at something. What the hell is he drawing down on?
What a freak.
But, you know, it's just not yeah. there yet for everyday nope. consumption like that. If they'd have followed something more of the form factor of like the Google Glass or the HoloLens, I think maybe they'd be a little bit closer. But they wanted it to do too much. They wanted it to do all the things. And it's just not ready for that yet.
I think so. There is a future
and where especially humans can... at that price point. That price point oh, yeah. is just fucking
$4,000. My God. If there's anything Apple's good at, it's coming yeah. out with the same thing other people have done far later. It's worse and much more expensive. That's just kind right. of their niche lately. But yeah, I mean,
I'm not here to shit on Apple Vision Pro. Trust me. When it came out, I told you and I stand by the fact that the release of this is going to spur innovation and technological advancement in other VR headsets as well, and it's already made a huge difference in the atmosphere and the structure of the MetaQuest 3, which is the one that I use. Things like stationary windows for travel.
Yeah.
You can now take it on an airplane and the window stays with you as opposed to shooting past your head when you move. You can now lie down and watch movies with the headset on while you're laying in a prone position, which you couldn't do before. I mean, little things, little updates, little ease of use updates yeah. that they're taking inspiration from the Apple Vision Pro. And likewise, I think the Apple Vision Pro, if it makes it to an next iteration, which I'm sure it will, Apple's got all the money in the world to throw at this shit.
They do.
They need to... Form and function is important. They want it to be they want it to be function over form. It's got to do both, and it's got to ride that line. If you want it to be an everyday wearable, it's got to ride that line.
Yeah, I think there is a market, or there at least will be a market, for a compact, everyday, enhanced reality thing that will allow you to minority report your way through life, but this just ain't it yet. This ain't it yet.
It ain't it won't yet, so... Looks like Max has shadow dropped season 2 of Velma.
Oh God, oh God, oh God, oh God.
The show that nobody asked for and nobody wants and is still here.
And nobody enjoyed.
I watched the first season of this show and I am underwhelmed to say the least. That's not me crapping on Mindy Kaling. I love Mindy Kaling. I think she's funny. But boy, I did not like Velma at all.
Yeah, and you weren't in the minority on that.
For whatever reason, I got approved for season 2. Critics are ripping it to shreds already following its recent debut. Debuted on Max on April 25th, which was yesterday after as of this recording. We don't have a Rotten Tomatoes score on it just yet, but the viewers are just roasting it, resulting in a viewer score of 15%.
Ouch.
For what it's worth, this is more than double the current season 1 audience score of 7%, but the season 2 score will likely fluctuate and possibly drop further as more reviews are added. Season 1 has a critic score of 39%, and reviews from season 2 are painting a similarly dreary picture. This is coming from a CBR article again. Let's see, what are the reviews saying? Velma Season 2 is an unfocused slog that fails to improve on Season 1.
Wow.
Further criticizing the season's, quote, flat jokes and bloated storytelling. Let's see, new season was not an improvement. The biggest drawback is its unlikable lead in Mindy Kaling's Velma. Selfish, self-centered, and judgmental. I gave it a 0.5 star because it wouldn't let me give it any less. Than the first.
I think there's room in entertainment for unsympathetic protagonists, for anti-heroes and people who aren't necessarily likable. I have a hard time with it a lot of the time. The first time I can remember ever really encountering a legitimately unlikable protagonist and then therefore not enjoying the work as a whole because of it was when I got assigned to Catcher in the Rye when I was in high school. It was obviously, it's an important book. People read it. It's one of those classics of American literature. And I did read it because I had to, and I hated it. To this day, I think it's one of the worst books I've ever read. And for somebody who was an English major and who writes for a living, it's maybe blasphemy to talk down any book that's considered a great work of American literature by damning it like that. But I hated it because Holden Caulfield was a whiny little piece of shit with no redeeming qualities, and I wasn't rooting for him. And again, I'm not saying everybody has to be a Pollyanna, Mary Sue, you know, white knight, whatever, in order to... People should be flawed. Characters should be flawed. They should have arcs. They should have struggles. But when they're just irredeemable little shits who, you know, flop their way through a piece of entertainment, just stinking up the joint, it's really hard to relate to that. And so there have been others that have been like that. There have been different things, different movies, different video games, different, you know, television shows that I've subjected myself to over the years where I go, God, I can't sympathize with this character. And it really affects my enjoyment of the overall product as a result. And I, unlike you, have not seen Velma, partially because I'm so far behind on my TV queue, I don't think I'll ever catch up, but also because I heard it was absolute dog shit, and therefore was like, well, if I'm going to watch anything, I should watch something I actually have at least a reasonable expectation that I'm going to enjoy. Yeah, this ain't it.
Speaking of things that I don't enjoy any longer, MAGA comedian Rob Schneider has recently taken to the media.
Oh, you piece of shit.
Calls report that his set was cut short at the GOP event, quote, woke bullshit. This coming from an article from Comic Sans. Actor and comedian Rob Schneider lashed out at claims his set at a GOP holiday gala in 2023 was so, quote, gross and vulgar, unquote, that it was cut short.
Don't have a hard time believing that.
The former Saturday Night Live cast member's performance was allegedly cut short by the event's host, which was a holiday gala for the Senate Working Group, SWG, which is a Republican networking group. According to Politico, the group later issued an apology following the incident. According to the report, Mississippi Republican Senator Cindy Hyde-Smith was among those offended by Schneider's set and decided to leave. A spokesman for the senator described the performance as gross and vulgar adding that Hyatt Smith, quote, didn't have to listen to it, so she got up and left. The event was slated to run for at least half an hour, but SWG Executive Director James Kimmy allegedly halted it after just 10 minutes due to the comedian's raunchy and inappropriate jokes as reported by individuals either in attendance or briefed on the performance. These jokes reportedly targeted Asian individuals, including a remark about a Korean whorehouse.
Which is pretty fucked, considering that Rob Schneider is, I think, half Filipino.
He's not a white guy for any stretch, but...
This just, it really, to me, speaks to the fact that there are just certain comedians who might have an established career, but then later in their career, they take a turn towards conservatism, and then they just start sucking out loud. Conservatives aren't funny. There is no conservative comedian on the right that's the equivalent of Jon Stewart. All we have are people like Roseanne Barr, who decided to go completely right-wing. We got Gallagher, who decided to go completely right-wing. And we have Rob Schneider, who decided to do that. And who's the old SNL Weekend Update anchor? Dennis, the guy with the hair? I've forgotten his name, Miller? Because he's not important. Dennis Miller, yeah. He used to be pretty lefty. He was, I don't want to get off on a rant here, but what's up with these fucking Republicans? And then he decided to jump to the other side of the aisle. And you'll notice that none of them have any relevance or any sort of press except outside, oh, you'll never believe the hate-filled rant that spewed out of Roseanne Barr's mouth. Oh, look at Rob Schneider getting kicked out of a Republican event because even he was too offensive. There's just no market there.
Well, Rob Schneider addressed the quote-unquote woke report in remarks to TMZ, insisting he'd done a full 50-minute set, saying, quote, I'm not changing my material or apologizing for my jokes to anybody. Enough with this woke bullshit. America's sick of it. I did 50 minutes because that's what I was paid to do. Nobody removed me from stage. Somebody waved to me at the 50-minute mark. However, the report goes on to say that the approximately 150 attendees, which included over 40 Senate chiefs of staff, received an email the following day containing an apology purportedly from Schneider's representatives that read, quote, while we do our best to ensure every aspect of our program is professional, courteous, and appropriate, we sincerely regret that the entertainment at last night's program fell short of that goal.
Yeah.
So, if they say professional, courteous, and appropriate, and it fell short of that goal, which means it's unprofessional, discourteous, and inappropriate.
I'm not somebody who agrees with censorship. I'm not. I'm not somebody who agrees with thought policing. I'm really not. Live your life the way you want, as long as you understand that there are going to be consequences for some of the choices you make. But if there's any one fucking word or concept I could strike from the Western lexicon, it's woke. Get fucked. Anything that Republicans don't like just goes in the woke bucket. All woke means is, hey, you know what? I have respect for other people's lived experience. I have respect for other people's backgrounds, ethnicities, gender expressions, sexual orientations, and differences that make them not like me. At the heart of everybody complaining about wokeness is just essentially them saying, why can't everybody else be straight, white, Christian, and male? In most cases. I mean, there are definitely some Karen ladies that bitch about the wokeness thing, but anybody who doesn't think like me is bad is at the center of every single person on the right who's ever bitched about wokeness. And that's all there is to it. It's just intolerance, bigotry, hatred, and a cop-out on understanding diversity. There are all different kinds of
people.
Why
can't I just say exactly what I want to say whenever I want to say it and get away with it?
I mean, you can. You can, but then you're going to wind up, you know, getting booted from theaters. You're not going to get a Netflix special. You're not going to actually have any relevance in culture. You're going to get relegated to playing partisan rubber chicken fundraising dinners at some congressional thing. And that's what you're going to get.
And even so, they don't like you now.
Yeah, I mean, people need to be reminded that the First Amendment does allow you to say whatever you want to say. But it doesn't protect you from the consequences of opening your mouth and sticking your entire ass in it. Don't be a dick. Sparkling
reap the whirlwind, Rob Schneider. Reap the whirlwind.
And we're going to take a second here, like we usually do at the midpoint, to talk about some show notes. But anybody who wants to stick with us after that is going to find out that a person in entertainment who happens to be a Schneider might actually kind of be a piece of shit. But we'll get to that in a minute.
We got one last news article here. Now I'm going to let Jim talk about this because there's certain things he likes to shit on. And Elon Musk is one of them. So, Jim, have at this last one.
Oh, man. Elon Musk. Where do I even start with this fucking ass clown? Elon Musk is... I mean, he likes to paint himself as an innovator. He likes to paint himself as somebody who is a visionary genius who runs all these companies. Somebody who is behind SpaceX. Somebody who is behind the Hyperloop. Somebody who is behind PayPal. And who is behind Tesla. And now who is behind Twitter. And I still refuse to call it that because if Elon can deadname his child, I can deadname his fucking company.
Boom! Drop the mic.
But agreed. The real truth about Elon is that he's a spoiled little silver spoon Nepo baby who is the son of emerald miners who benefited from apartheid in South Africa, and he just ain't all that. We've talked before about how a lot of people turned against him when he actually offered to build a submarine to go and get those Thai soccer kids out of that cave, and then when somebody else decided to go take it on, he accused him of being a pedophile because he was a Western person in Thailand. And of course, as everybody knows, you wouldn't be a Western person in Thailand unless you're a pedophile, unless you're that's the place your brain went because that is what is wrong with you. Not that I'm casting any aspersions. Don't sue me. Don't come at me. You have more money than I do. At least that much I will give you. But Elon Musk has not innovated shit. He bought his way into all these companies. You can't make the argument that he was a little bit of a visionary behind things like PayPal and SpaceX, but these technologies were existing before he came along and decided to invest in them and then install himself as the figurehead. Elon Musk didn't invent Tesla. He bought Tesla. Tesla was first incorporated in July of 2003 by two guys named Martin Eberhard and Mark Tarpenning. Okay? And Elon Musk didn't come on board until 2008. He became the largest shareholder and was then named CEO, but Tesla was a going concern, and a lot of the research, a lot of the R&D that formed the underlying crux of what Tesla is today was in place well before he showed up. So he didn't innovate it. He didn't start it. He didn't come up with the idea. He didn't build the technology, but he bought into it. So a lot of what's happening with Tesla now, the first couple of rounds of what Tesla did with like the Model 3 and the Model X and a lot of the Teslas that when I was living in San Francisco in 2018, a lot of the Teslas I saw on the road were products of that original R&D, were things that were on the drawing board that were brought to fruition and brought to market because of those original founders, the ideas that they had, and the things that have been happening as a result of their work. Then we come to the Cybertruck. Jesus Christ, the fucking Cybertruck.
Which everyone not since blames the... on Elon. And of course, I want you to, as much as I love shooting on Elon, again, he's just the face, the forward-fronting face of this company.
He is, but he also apparently reportedly, according to most information, did have a very heavy hand when it came to the design, advancement, and promotion, and marketing, and production of the Cybertruck. The Cybertruck looks like a PlayStation 1 Pontiac Aztec. Let's just say that. Let's get that out of the way right away. it has several different design flaws that have been coming out. Things like people have been driving their Tesla's Cybertrucks off the lot, and computer system, which it runs off everything, is off a screen, like a big tablet on the dashboard, has been blue screening and setting off klaxon alarms saying that there's something wrong. The Tesla has several pinch points on things like the trunk and the doors where people's fingers could get taken off if they weren't paying attention. The Tesla supposedly has bulletproof windows, but they will go ahead and still crack so you can't see out of them if you throw something at them. And that was something that Elon had to eat crow over during one of the demonstrations of the Cybertruck in the early prototype stage. The Tesla has doors that really can't be accessed from the outside unless you have some sort of key or a thumbprint, or I'm not even really sure how it works. But if somebody were to drive their Tesla into a river or a body of water, rescuers wouldn't be able to get them out because of the fucking stupid windows and the fact that you can't get in from outside unless you have the key. And Tesla also famously was manufactured without any kind of crumple zones. So if you get into an accident, you're pretty much dead because your entire body's going to rattle around in that thing like a peanut in a can. Tesla also, Cybertruck, doesn't have any traction in sand or snow. It only has a towing capacity of, I think, somewhere in the neighborhood of like a ton and a half. And when you do tow something with it, your range drops to about 150 miles. But very recently, Tesla also had to recall all 4,000 Cybertrucks that were sold because somebody used an unauthorized lubricant on the accelerator, which, if you're actually using the accelerator with your foot, like it's intended to do, can cause the chrome covering on top of the accelerator to slip off and wedge itself under a body panel, causing the accelerator to stick to the floor, which, if you're in a moving vehicle, that's what the kids call bad. But then, on top of all of that egregious design bullshit that any other vehicle would not be approved for safety ratings to be on the road for, you can't put your Tesla through a car wash. Not just because if you do that, it's going to rust. It's supposedly made of stainless steel like the old DeLoreans were. Tip of the hat to Paul Haggai on that one. But if you get caught in the rain, you're supposed to wipe it down immediately. Otherwise, you can get rust spots. And there are already people who are saying that they are getting rust spots. But the other great thing about that is, you literally, it's in your user agreement that if you take your test through a car wash, you void your fucking warranty. And the reason for that is because there are poorly insulated wires that run through certain sections of the body panels that sort of pan out on the bottom and sort of act as a basin. So if water collects in them, the wiring of your electrical system, and again, this is an electrical vehicle, is going to be sitting in the water. And your whole shit could short out, and you void your warranty. Oh, yep. And I also forgot that the wheel covers, the fancy wheel covers they put on, if you accidentally scrape your hubcap while you're trying to park or something, there's little fins that can bend and dig into the tire. And I mean, there's just, if you tried to create a vehicle that was built of nothing but design flaws, you wouldn't be able to do better slash worse than the goddamn Cybertruck. And this, by a lot of reports, is one of the first vehicles that Tesla has produced that Elon Musk has been primarily the driving force behind the design and structure of. So there you go. There's your genius innovator, Elon Musk, making a car that you can't put through a car wash because it's an electrical vehicle and the entire fucking thing will short out and void your warranty. Way to go, Elon Musk. You goddamn genius.
Way to go. Yeah, that's the report that I saw. It was talking about how you have to have it in some kind of special car wash mode to go through a car wash. And like you said, it's been one catastrophe after another with this vehicle. And yes, I'm all for innovation in electrical vehicles and things like that. I love new technology. And certain aspects of this vehicle do, in fact, pique my curiosity. But how many red flags before the whole thing just is nothing but red flags, you know?
Yeah.
We've talked about electric vehicles at one point or another as well being the way of the future as our dependence on fossil fuels needs to deteriorate. And we talked about the fact that they need to do some kind of innovative designs to make that something that is not just sustainable, but something that is desirable.
Yeah, especially because even though they're electric powered, you still have to mine the coal to fuel the plants to create the electricity. You still have to mine the rare earth minerals to go in there and create the batteries until they come up with an innovation for that. So even though they're lower emission and therefore, I guess, ostensibly better for the environment, there's still issues that still have to be addressed. And so we've seen a decline in the demand for electronic vehicles kind of across the board. Rivian is apparently having a hard time. Karma. Marcus Brownlee, who's one of the most revered tech reviewers online, gave the Fisker Karma, said it was the worst vehicle he's ever reviewed. Tesla shares are down. Electric vehicles, the sort of banner brands across the board, are having some serious issues in the market right now, whether it's due to sales or perception or press or technology or what. And I think this might be another case of like the Apple Vision Pro goggles. I mean, these things exist and they are innovative, but they're just not quite where they need to be yet in order to really usurp the things that came before and replace what came before. The Apple Vision Pro is not going to replace your laptop or your cell phone. The Tesla Cybertruck is not going to replace your Ford F-150. And as much as we kind of need to get away from some of these aging technologies, the new things they're coming up with to either replace or enhance them are just not ready for prime time yet.
I agree. So keep an eye out. I still haven't seen one of these in person yet. Apparently there's a couple in the area. I've got a couple of my train crews have said they've seen them, but I haven't seen any of them. So.
Well, they've only sold fewer than 3,900 of them, and all of those are going to be going back to the dealership to get the accelerator replaced so that people don't die in fiery crashes. Imagine having a conflation of all of these problems at the same time. I took my Tesla through the car wash, so my wiring started to short out. And while I was busy trying to deal with the tablet on my dashboard, trying to figure out why things were going wrong, my accelerator stuck to the floor because the pedal was not glued down properly. And then I ran into a river, and the rescuers couldn't get to me because they couldn't open the door from the outside, and I died because of all of these shitty ideas that Elon Muskie put into his fucking truck. No. Hard pass.
Yep. Just not the move at this point, so. But, all that being said, not the topic of today's conversation, no. But before we get to the topic, we want to remind everybody that the Fuel Your Fandom podcast is never intended to be a one-way conduit of conversation. No, we require, request, and desire your input. And there's a couple of different ways that you can go about doing that. You can drop us a line on Facebook, facebook.com/FuelYourFandom. You can send us an email at FuelYourFandom@gmail.com.
Or at FYFTalentBooking@gmail.com. And as much as I'm bitching about Zuckerberg on this episode, you can still find us on Instagram and Threads at FuelYourFandom. And any place fine podcasts are bought, sold, stolen, traded, or bartered, you will find the Fuel Your Fandom podcast. But as ever, if you don't want to wait, and I often don't, you can always find every episode up bright and early, thanks to my boy Saint over there, over at fuelyourfandom.buzzsprout.com. That is BUZZSPROUT, Buzzsprout, yay. Fuel Your Fandom at fuelyourfandom.buzzsprout.com is where you can find us. And whoever you do, we're thrilled you do. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. We love it. Okay, all that lightness and fun aside, it's time to set all that onto the other side of the table because today's topic's a little bit hard to talk about. And I know we just did a big old long mental health check-in episode a few weeks ago, and this is not that. Nope. This is definitely a key response to that. There was a reason that we did the check-in. And, of course, we talked about Steve from Blue's Clues jumping in and checking in with people and Elmo and everyone doing that. And there was a reason that they were doing that. And the reason that they all had jumped onto social media to check on the youths was because of a documentary series that came out on Max called Quiet on Set.
Mm-hmm.
And I watched the entire thing all in one go, with the exception of the final episode, which aired later.
Same.
But it, boy, it sparked a lot of thoughts. It sparked a lot of discussion on the internet. It sparked a lot of emotions in a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And that's why people like Steve Burns and Elmo and everyone were checking in on people, because it has to do with the behind-the-scenes activities primarily of one company, and that's Nickelodeon, during the late 90s and early 2000s, under the guidance of one Dan Schneider. And Jim had made mention of there being a Schneider we were going to talk about that was a problematic douchebag, and here we are, here we sit. These documentaries do not paint Dan Schneider in a very, very good light.
They do not.
Anyone who's... And we've given it enough time, so this isn't something I would consider spoiler territory. I mean, this isn't fiction. Okay? So, the spoiler moratorium on fiction I get, but this is something that is... I guess you would... Would you label this true crime?
Yeah, because it's true, and there's definitely crime involved.
For real. But Jim and I have made no small point of the fact that how we met was involved with a website called Perverted Justice. We were social justice vigilantes on the good old interwebs, tracking down pedophiles and exposing them online initially, and then after that being legitimized by police departments and the FBI and NBC's Dateline to do that officially for them. And so we've got our fair share of experience in dealing with this particular type of issue, this particular type of child abandonment, child endangerment.
Ironically, we were active right around the same time a lot of this shit was happening.
Which we didn't know about.
No, we didn't. Nobody did, because they were very careful to conceal it. And there's a lot of issues at play here, not just power differentials. If you've got anybody who's worked in entertainment, there's a definite pecking order. There's a definite hierarchy of, well, you got your directors, you got your showrunners, you got your writers, you got your cast, crew, and performers, and all this. And that's a thing that's pretty well established. But there's a whole different dynamic when you're talking about adults who are in charge of children's programming. Now, obviously, if you turned over a TV studio to a bunch of kids, you know, there's not going to be... Kids are amazing. They're great, don't get me wrong, but you're not going to find a kid sitting in a bank of editing monitors in Video Village trying to piece together a show. Eventually, they could learn to do that, but if you're talking about 10, 12, 13-year-olds, they're still trying to learn geography and math and English at school. So the adults, if you're going to make programming aimed at kids that stars kids, you got to have some grown-ups involved. And unfortunately, Nickelodeon didn't make the greatest choices when it came to that. Now, Dan Schneider is a guy who I first became aware of in the 80s. I actually used to watch a show called Head of the Class. It was Howard Hessman, who plays Johnny Fever on the old WKRP in Cincinnati show. And he became the show was about a teacher who was asked to head up a gifted and talented program at his high school. And so they had to hire actors who were to play the sort of nerdy gifted kids, and somebody who was in a program much like that in my own school. I related to this pretty heavily at the time. I was right around that age. And Dan Schneider played one of the kids who was on this show. And he was an actor first, and then after a while, he was also, if you ever watched the movie Better Off Dead with John Cusack, he was Ricky the Neighbor, who was the creepy kid, a little bit of foreshadowing, who was trying to, his mom was trying to hook him up with the French exchange student. So, yeah, it's a whole thing. But he went on to be a showrunner for Nickelodeon, and the last nice thing anybody can really say about him is he definitely created some pretty successful programming. He was the creative showrunner behind shows like All That, iCarly, Sam and Cat, a lot of the sort of programs that the Gen Zers and Millennials grew up with, because they starred kids that were roughly their same age. And
right.
By all accounts, these shows are great, but at what a cost. And also Drake and Josh, which will come up pretty importantly later.
Right.
Yeah, but he was the showrunner behind those shows, and by all accounts, those shows were great. But they also, especially in retrospect, had some aspects to them that should have been red flags at the time. But because of the power differential and the kids, and of course their kids' parents, who in many cases were counting on these kids to bring in family income in an incredibly competitive Hollywood-driven entertainment industry, they let a lot of shit go that they really shouldn't have. And that looking back on it now, you think, how did they miss that shit? And if you've seen the Quiet on Set documentary, you know exactly what I'm talking about. And if you haven't, then I encourage you to watch it. It's a tough watch, but it's an important watch.
Absolutely, and I think that's kind of we want to start this whole thing off by saying yes, absolutely. If you've got the stomach for it, go and check this out. I mean, it's not, I don't know, it is certainly compelling as a watch goes, but given its subject matter, it can be kind of difficult. So just go in armed with that knowledge, and I want to start off by saying, you know, Dan Schneider was not, as far as we're aware, according to this documentary and what I've been able to read in the news, was not one of the individuals that was implicated in sexual abuse of a minor.
No.
Let's get that out of the way, because there is some of that coming, and that is not one of the things that we're going to level at Dan Schneider's doorstep.
Nope.
However, that being said, his shit was problematic enough. Certainly not to that degree, and of course, it's a matter of degrees at this point. But the fact of the matter is that Dan Schneider was responsible for the on-set atmosphere behind several of these shows, from started out with the Amanda Bynes show, the Amanda Show, all that, the reboot of all that, iCarly, Drake and Josh, Sam and Cat, Victorious, the Thundermans. Also, I mean, there's just his fingerprint was all over Nickelodeon at the time.
And he was, even if not directly responsible for any cases of direct abuse that we can trace back to him, sexual abuse of minors in particular, he still was the person at whose desk the buck stopped. And so the environment he created, even if he wasn't directly responsible for it, he's kind of a, you know, I kind of, watching this, I got the sense that he was like a Charles Manson figure. No, Charles Manson didn't directly kill anybody, but he nonetheless was the figurehead of an organization where people below him did commit very serious crimes.
Correct. And so, again, I wanted to be very, very upfront and honest about that open at the beginning, that the most serious of these charges we are not laying at Dan Schneider's doorstep, but no. There are enough, he's got enough problems to deal with. And so, like we said, he was the showrunner for a lot of these early Nickelodeon shows. He was kind of the wunderkind over at Nickelodeon. And so, like, what he said was law. What he wanted, he got, by and large. And what that sponsored was a large part of the first couple episodes of Quiet on Set dealt with the fact that not even anything to do with the kids. It was a matter of female writers on staff in his writer's room. And how he had a pair of female writers who were splitting a salary, which is illegal.
Illegal as hell. Which
they didn't know was illegal. He, quote unquote, didn't know it was illegal. And as soon as it was brought to his attention, was rectified. But then subsequently, one of them was fired anyway. So the matter resolved itself. Hey, look at that.
Yeah, how about
magic.
That?
Magic. Problem but, very toxic environment. And in one particular instance, a woman was forced to feign anal intercourse while pitching an idea in order to get, I don't know if it was for money. I think it was for money. Or for a, I forget what exactly they said she was doing.
Or to get a sketch on the show. Some sort of benefit. Which, right. Again, like, if you know anything about sexual harassment in the workplace, that's the definition of it. You're going to have to endure sort of gender-based harassment and sexual-based harassment in order to advance your career or enjoy some sort of workplace benefit.
Right. And so there's certainly that. And then if you look at the content of the programs as it goes on, one of the other big accusations laid at Dan's doorstep was the fact that a lot of the content that these kids were being put into, the situational content, was risque as hell. Simulated cum shots, for instance, or over-focus on feet. Simulated sexual acts, focus on feet.
If you Google a Hollywood foot fetishist, you're going to get largely two results that top your results. There's going to be Quentin Tarantino, and there's going to be Dan Schneider. And as much as you can like kind of look at Quentin Tarantino askance, he's an adult. He's got a kink, sure, fine, whatever. He indulges it with other adults. And anything that's come
creepy,
out about that,
but okay.
There have been people that have said, yeah, I was in a relationship with him, and whatever. But at least, at the very least, you can think Quentin Tarantino's foot fetish kink is creepy or weird or whatever, but it's his, and he engages in it with an adults, and by all accounts, it's been consensual. Sure, fine, whatever. But Dan Schneider focusing on feet. And then the other thing that came out during this was that he used to ask for massages, back rubs from people on set. Always the women, occasionally the younger female stars, and occasionally also his writers or producers. But you go, oh, I'm working so hard. Why don't you go ahead and dig in there and give me a little bit of a massage, which, holy shit.
Yeah, it's sexual exploitation, 100%.
Yep. Non-consensual.
And definitely using your power to gain benefit over those under your control. And a lot of people felt that they just had to go with it because This was the environment that he had created. It was his way or the highway. He was the Wonder Boy. He could do no wrong. Greenlit show after greenlit show. He was a star maker at that point. He made a star out of Amanda Bynes. He made a star out of Keenan and Kel. He made a star out of, you know, Drake Bell, Josh. He made a star out of, like, you know,
Victoria all of Justice. These,
Victoria Justice, and I'm trying to think of the girl from iCarly's name. Miranda Cosgrove. He made stars out of all of these people, gave them careers, gave them...
Jeanette McCurdy.
Yeah. Oh, we'll talk about Jeanette a bit more here.
Oh, yeah. But in the process of doing that, he created this toxic work environment that not only was he the figurehead of, and he got up to some questionable shit in terms of his personal conduct and also what he allowed on his set and what he shot and all that. But this documentary also exposes that there were at least two people who worked on his productions who later went on to be criminally convicted of inappropriate sexual, not that there's any appropriate sexual abuse of a child, but inappropriate touching, sexual abuse of a child, sexual exploitation of minors. There were two of them. One, Jason Michael Handy, who described himself as a full-blown pedophile in court documents that they were able to obtain from his personal correspondence. He sent explicit photographs to child actresses, and he was sentenced to 6 years in prison on related charges in 2004. But the documentary also focuses a lot on Brian Peck. Now, it's important to point out that Brian Peck is no relation to Josh Peck, who was Drake Bell's co-star in Drake and Josh. But Brian Peck was on set as a production assistant, helped out with a lot of behind-the-scenes things, but also showed up. And again, in retrospect, you look back on this and you're like, how did this get out? His primary character on one of these shows, he turned up as Pickle Boy.
Pickle Boy.
He walked around with a giant tray of phallic objects and used to shove them through doorknob holes and into the mouths of people. And these clips made the air. He was Pickle Boy. And this documentary, it was known that he was charged, arrested, tried, and convicted of sexual assault. But until this documentary came out, it wasn't known who the person was that he victimized. And so the bombshell that dropped of this documentary is that the victim was none other than Drake Bell, who is a very well-known actor even now. First appeared on The Amanda Show and later got his own spinoff, Drake and Josh. And then even went on to go star in a lot... Craig Mazin, who is a guy that I worked with a little bit when I was in Hollywood on screenwriting things, directed and wrote Superhero Movie, where Drake Bell played the Dragonfly, the lead role in one of these spoof movies of sort of the superhero genre. So he's had a career. He's a well-known public figure and was a child star that, at least to a certain extent, has successfully made a leap to adult star, but not without a lot of turmoil and a lot of personal cost and trauma to get there.
I think he played the grown-up Timmy Turner on... they did like a live-action Fairly Odd Parents movie as well. And he played Timmy Turner on that, as far as I recall. But, I mean, yeah. And so the first couple episodes focus primarily on, you know, Dan Schneider and his behind-the-scenes shenanigans. And
his creepery.
You know, creepery. General creepery. But then the next couple episodes are when we introduce Drake Bell, and we get to hear his side of the story. And go into it knowing that it's really hard to listen to. It's going to be something that, again, it's one of those things where it's troublesome to hear. It's you get uncomfortable listening to it, but you have to listen to it. Because this is, I mean, this was literally the point of this documentary. Mm-hmm. Child endangerment on film sets is the big purpose of this documentary. And it was earth-shattering. And I know we've talked about how Drake Bell had his run-ins with the law, inappropriate text communications with a minor, and things of that nature. And we also talked about how hurt people hurt people.
And how it's possible to be a victim and a perpetrator at the same time.
Right. So we're not trying to sit here and make excuses for Drake Bell. By God, no. Nope. What he did, he should pay for. His punishment should be, you know, the same as anyone else's when they're caught doing that crime. We're not calling for a lesser sentence, but what we are calling for is a bit of understanding in the realm of hurt people. And that's kind of the understanding that we need to come to with this. Drake Bell was he was hurt by this. I mean, and once you hear the stories, it's certainly not something you can unhear.
No.
But it's something that I'm having a hard time even thinking about it because it's so disturbing. I've got a history of this in my family line of people in my family being abused and taken advantage of sexually, and it's not something I take an easy view of. It's why I did things like Perverted Justice.
Yeah, we've had conversations over the years a lot about how that was one of the things that that even though you know, I've been very lucky. I was never somebody who was abused as a child, but having that kind of thing in your family can't, you know, it brings you a little bit of closure to be able to think, well, maybe I couldn't have prevented this from people I care about, but I can do what I can to get in the way of it possibly happening to somebody else. And there are a lot of people that we worked with during the Perverted Justice years that either were abuse victims themselves or who had, you know, loved ones that had suffered that they thought, well, I can't change the past, but I can maybe affect somebody else's future.
Right. And so that's what I feel is one of the biggest benefits of this documentary is, like, going forward, it shines a light on, hey, this kind of shit's going on. Whether you want to hear about it or not, whether you care about it or not, this shit's going on. So if you've got a child that wants to go into Hollywood, this is definitely something you need to be on the lookout for. Or in case of, like, with what happened to Drake Bell, here's some of what grooming is. This is how he was groomed. This is how he was treated. This is how that
happens.
Right. These are the red flags to look out for so it doesn't happen to anyone that you love.
And one of the things that really struck me as I was watching this series is that if you are somebody who... Marvel has taught us all to sit through credits because there could be bonuses at the end. And even further back than that, Ferris Bueller. You know, the post-credits scene is not something that's new in Hollywood. So I'm somebody, not just because of the post-credits scene, but also somebody who, you know, tried to work in Hollywood at one point. I sit through credits and I read the credits because those people worked hard on the movie and they deserve to have their moment in the sun. But at the end of every movie... Most movies, anyway, you'll see a little disclaimer saying that, the American Humane Association was on set to monitor to make sure that no animals were harmed during the production of this film or television show. But, you know, you don't see that. Nobody's saying, hey, there was an organization on set to make sure none of the kids were hurt. Right. And I'm not saying that any life is worth less than any other. You should protect animals. Obviously, you should protect animals. I mean, even in movies like Indiana Jones, where they are shuffling their way through giant fields of Madagascar hissing cockroaches, you'll see at the end, even the least of the creatures used on... They'll even sometimes use that language. Even the least of God's creatures were treated with dignity and respect and were not harmed. And the American Humane Society was on set to make sure that that was the case. The fact that we need to have some sort of organization that's monitoring whether or not the kids on set were harmed is about as ridiculous as those warnings on the dashboards of cars saying, hey, did you leave your kid in the car seat? You shouldn't have to have that. But that's the thing that jumped out at me was we make sure animals are fine on set, but we don't do the same for kids? The fuck is that about?
Yeah, I mean... This isn't bringing up anything new, unfortunately. This documentary series is just shining a light on something that we already knew happened. I mean, look at... there's been a whole lot of child stars who have grown up to become adult stars and have moderate levels of success. But there's also the ones that made it. They didn't make it. They slipped through the cracks.
Yeah.
Like your River Phoenix or... I mean, even Drew Barrymore.
Or Jonathan Brandis, you know, who were just really troubled and who didn't make it out. I mean, there are a lot of child stars, like Drew Barrymore or Neil Patrick Harris or even Kurt Russell, who were able to make that successful transition. But for every one of those, it seems like there's 10 who just get left behind by the system.
Yeah.
And a lot of the kids on this documentary. Yeah. A lot of the kids in this series who were caught up with, even if they weren't somebody who directly experienced quantifiable abuse, they still had a hard time with saying, hey, I aged out of viability as an actor when I was 15 fucking years old. You know, I grew up, I got too tall, my voice changed, I started having to shave, maybe my body changed in ways that weren't appropriate for being on children's shows, and I got cut, and I was on top of the world 1 month, and then the next month I was a nobody, and I've been a nobody ever since. And that's hard enough for even adult actors who might experience setbacks in their career. For a kid who's still figuring out who they are and piecing together who they're going to become.
Life shattering. Even,
and then if you add some abuse in on top of that, plus, not to say nothing of the economic pressure, because a lot of these parents, either they push their kids into showbiz, but most of the parents on this documentary didn't. Their kids wanted to act, and their parents supported them in that. And then these kids became a breadwinner for the family. We mentioned Jeanette McCurdy a little earlier. Jeanette McCurdy is no longer acting. Because she had an overbearing stage mom. She wrote a book about her experience called I'm Glad My Mom Died, which is deliberately provocative.
Yeah.
And I have not read the book yet. It is on my nightstand. I have a physical copy of it. I'm going to get to it. But I have listened to several podcasts where she talks about the nature and the content of the book. And she had a very overbearing stage mom who tried to become a child actor when she was a kid, failed at it, and so she decided to push her own kid. And even though Jeanette was, by her own admission, not necessarily physically abused, or at least not sexually abused, she was physically abused because her mom was constantly pushing her to eat nothing so she would look slim and pretty and be able to fit into the costumes. She constantly pushed her to rehearse and to hone her skills at the expense of developing things like social skills or an education. It was abuse of a different sort, but it was still abuse. And these days, she's so burned out on it that she has said, I will never act again. I'm doing other things. I'm doing a podcast. I'm writing these books. I'm trying to find ways to sustain myself that have nothing to do with entertainment. Even as I acknowledge in some entertainment platforms that people have an interest in what I used to do because I was such a high-profile person, and they've kind of wondered where I've been and if I'm okay, I'm right here, and I'm not okay. And here's why. But there's just very, very few people who manage to emerge unscathed from that child stardom. And for years we've heard about, you know, kids on set and how they have to be, they still have to get an education and they have to do all these things. But
that's even all though window kids dressing, in, it seems like
it is, at this it point. Is. Kids in entertainment are necessary because you're going to create stories. You're going to have TV shows and movies where you have to have characters that are younger characters. And you can't keep on casting 35-year-olds as high schoolers. If you need a 10-year-old, you got to find somebody who's roughly that same age because they're going to be a 10-year-old. But there needs to be, and I think this documentary might be the catalyst that actually spurs some of these changes in the industry, there needs to be a certain amount of oversight, of just advocacy for some of these actors that are just not only eaten and chewed up and spit out by the system as, you know, I got my beard, I got my boobs, and now I'm not going to be able to be an actor anymore, but also people who've suffered horrendous abuse at the hands of some of these people who exploit them. I'm not sure what the answer is. Like I said, I only dipped my toe into the world of entertainment for the most part. I barely scratched the surface of it while I was in L.A. But, it's just a lot. It's a lot, and there's just no real good answers for any of it.
There's not. And like you said, if advocacy is the thing that comes out of this the most, then I'm all for it. Again, we have all these, you know, tales of child stars who have grown up now who talk about, oh, yeah, I started drinking and doing drugs at, like, age 13. And,
yeah.
And you know, I was out partying at age 16. And, you know, Carrie Fisher and fucking Drew Barrymore. And just, we hear this all the time. And it's like, I don't know how the fuck I'm still alive. It's like.
No, a lot of them aren't.
Some aren't. Yeah. And, I mean, look at. It's extremely difficult when I have a 19-year-old right now. I have an almost 13-year-old now, 12-year-old right now. And to imagine them in that kind of a place, it scares the fuck out of me. It honestly does. Because It's like, I would never want that for my child. I would never want them to feel those kind of pressures. I would never want them to feel the weight of a drug addiction problem or an alcohol addiction problem, or sexual issues, or things like that. It's like, I go out of my way to protect my kids from these kind of issues.
It occurred to me that you being a dad, especially somebody who has a track record of before your kids even came along, being in this world and seeing what some of these people, because we weren't kids, but we played kids. And I frequently tell the story whenever it comes up in sort of social situations about perverted justice that, you know, well, surely there were times that, you know, that nothing happened. No, we were tasked with creating these underage personas, heading out into local chat rooms, not even fetish or adult chat rooms or anything even remotely inappropriate or adult, and just sitting there like a bear trap And just you know, being there. And then if somebody came along, of course, with the classic internet greeting of ASL, age, sex, location, oh, you know, 13 female Denver, or, you know, 14 female Miami, whatever it was, wherever we were working at the time. I don't know about you, but I'm sure your experience was consistent with mine, that when we created these personas, went out there sort of as just an inert presence, an entity that somebody who had the inclination to be attracted to or try to exploit children would notice and try to isolate from the pack and groom for whatever reason. I never once, when I was tasked with creating a profile and heading out into a chat room in an attempt to try and find somebody who might solicit me, never 100, I can't stress enough, 100% of the time, 100% of the time, and it was never, not once, more than 5 or 10 minutes before somebody would try to talk to me and say things that were inappropriate. That would have been inappropriate had I actually been the child I was representing myself to be. Not once. 100% of the time, and no more than 10 minutes. Every time.
It does make it difficult. And like I said, when I started off being a parent, definitely that was first and foremost on my mind, is the fact that, you know, I'm bringing children into this world that I already know from personal experience, from vast personal experience at that point, is a shit show start to finish.
Yep.
It's like, but so I had to go out of my way to advocate for my children, to be there for my children, to safeguard my children, to be the one to say, okay, my daughter does not have Google on her phone for a reason. Yeah. You know, my kids are not allowed in chat rooms for a reason. You know, my daughter does not play Roblox with chat on if she plays it. All of her chats inside these programs are disabled for a reason. You know, because I look after my children, I do the best that I can, and I know there's ways to circumvent it. There's always going to be new methods to circumvent, and kids are going to get creative and try to find a way around it and try to be sneaky and try to be adult. And it's your job as a parent to kind of be on the forefront of that and go, like, be paying enough attention to your child to notice that things are getting a little bit weird, you know?
And you have a distinct advantage because you worked on the other side of it. And not just us being Gen Xers, the, you know, sort of last or the only generation that existed in both a pre-digital world as fully fledged people and a post-digital world as fully fledged people. A lot of the stuff came along while we were in our formative years. So we know what to look for. And we at least know kind of what some of the warning signs and red flags are. And we can put safeguards into place. And like you said, you can't do everything. But by the virtue of the fact that we're Gen Xers, and also by the virtue of the fact that we were on the other side of this and saw what some of these people do and the methods they used and the way they did it and the things they said and what the result of that was, we're better armed than I think a lot of people might be to be able to spot that stuff. But you know, like you said, you can only do so much. You can only helicopter parent so much. You can only breathe down their necks so much. And we used to tell people this when we used to do training sessions with parent groups and law enforcement as a result of the affiliation we had with Dateline and Perverted Justice. Your kids are going to fucking hate you. They're going to hate you for the monitoring. Yep. They're going to hate you for the blocks. They're going to hate you for breathing down their necks. They're going to hate you for, give me your phone, unlock it, let me look and see what you've been up to. They're going to hate you for it. But they're going to thank you for it if all of that keeps them from being a victim. If all of that keeps people from hurting them and giving them a lifetime of fallout and trauma from something that shouldn't have happened.
I think that's a large part of the misconception about being a parent to a kid these age too.
Yeah.
Is you see the TikTok parents, you see the Instagram parents, you want to be your kid's best friend. You want to be your kid's, you know, your buddy, your pal. And I do. Believe me, I love it when my kids want to hang out with me, play video games with me, go to movies with me, just kick it with me. I love that more than anything. I treasure that. I cherish that. But I am not their friend.
Yeah.
I am not. Because if I have to make a choice over being their friend or their parent, I'm their parent 100% of the time.
Yeah.
And the fact of the matter is parents have to be forced to make choices that a friend would not have to make. Mm-hmm. Parents are forced to say, you cannot do this and why.
And then be prepared to enforce that boundary if necessary.
And you will have to enforce it. You'll have to be the bad guy. You'll have to be the one that says, oh, you violated that rule, give me your phone for a week. You violated that rule, you're fucking grounded for a month.
Because we're adults. You know? We were kids. We were kids, so we know what that's like. They haven't been adults yet. So, like it or not, we have a better perspective.
Exactly that. And so you have to be your kid's protector. You have to be your kid's guardian. You cannot be your kid's just bestie. You know, that's not your role.
No.
I mean,
and you and I both know also, both from working with Perverted Justice and having been, I'm a former child. You're a former child. There's nothing
far too
more that you
for my kids, but
yeah, there's. I mean, I still have my inner child who plays with things. Nonetheless, there's a certain amount of when you're a kid, you're in such a hurry to grow up. You're in such a hurry to be seen as mature and wise beyond your years and an old soul.
Absolutely.
You see things from the outside perspective of like, oh, you're a grown-up. You can drive. You can drink. You can have money. But, you know, you don't understand that drinking comes with hangovers. To earn the money, you have to have a job. Driving, you risk accidents. All they see is the good stuff from the outside, and they want to grow up so fast. So if somebody comes along and treats them like a grown-up, oh, you're so mature. We saw this all the time coming from the people that we talked to.
It's called
in the chat rooms.
Grooming.
It's called grooming. Oh, you're clearly so mature for your age, and I really like that. And I see that as an adult. I am validating your perspective and your experience, and I'm going to say that you're very grown-up for your age. And it's flattering, and it's wish fulfillment, and it ties into things that they want. But from the outside, all kids see is the cool part about being an adult. You know, they don't see the responsibility. They say, when I grow up, I'm going to have parties every night, and I'm going to get my own apartment, and I'm going to, you know, eat whatever I want. And then they realize, oh, to get your own apartment, you have to have a job, you got to work all the time, and then you're too tired to party. You can eat whatever you want for a couple years, but then you're going to, you know, you're going to have health problems if you do that. And I'm going to drink until I can't stand. Cool. And then you're going to be sick for 3 days. So they don't understand the actual experience of it. All they see is adults get to do whatever they want. And that's all they want, and that's all they see. And so it's kind of up to authority figures who are responsible and conscientious, parents, teachers, people who have their best interests at heart, to let them know, hey, yeah, there's a lot of cool stuff that comes along with being a grown-up, but there's also a lot of responsibility. I saw either a meme on Facebook or a tweet or some sort of internet minutia where somebody was talking to a kid that they were behind at an ice cream shop. And this adult was buying all kinds of ice cream, and the kid was there with their parent, and they got like a triple scoop of ice cream. It was a rough week. They wanted to treat themselves. And the kid said kind of out loud, where the ice cream buyer could hear, hey, I can't wait till I'm a grown-up and I can have all the ice cream I want. And then this person took it upon themselves to bend over to the kid and say, yeah, you know what? You're right. As an adult, you can't have all the ice cream you want. You just have to buy it yourself. And the kid's face went from like joy at, oh, all the ice cream I could possibly want, to the horror of, wait, what? I have to buy it. Nobody's going to take care of me. Nobody's going to shelter, feed, and clothe me and provide me with everything I need. I have to get that shit for myself. Yeah. There's a tipping point. And it comes sooner than you think, and it lasts longer than you might like.
Right. And so we talk about the fact that you have to be, you know, your kid's advocate. You have to be your kid's guardian. You have to protect your children. That has to be your purpose. You can't be this buddy-buddy to them. You can't, but also at the same time, you can't do what these helicopter parents on these sets did. It was just force your kid to be the prize, the breadwinner, the prize cow at the county fair. You have to protect them there as well. And so there's a large part of this is awareness. When I tell people to watch this documentary, it's not that it's compelling TV. It's not that it's, you know, edge of your seat shit. It was hard for me to watch. Hard, yeah. And I had definite feelings after watching it, and knowing that when I finished it that they were still working on an episode 5, and that there's potentially going to be a second season of this, is horrifying to me.
Yeah, if you're somebody who's inappropriate with kids over the Disney Channel, you're probably shitting yourself about now. But I also watched it with a certain amount. Yeah, oh, you should be, because Brian Peck, the guy who was charged, arrested, convicted, and sentenced for his treatment of Drake Bell, when he got out, he went to go work for the Disney Channel. He worked
because
on the street life of Zach and Cody.
We didn't have protections in place.
I watched this documentary with a certain amount of interest because of the activities that you and I used to engage in terms of fighting predators. But right. I also have been very interested by the reception of it and how much it's talked about, because of some things that we have to talk about very delicately in terms of a documentary project that we were involved with that's also going to be hitting streaming probably later this year. So seeing the reception of this and seeing the sort of public interest in it and seeing these sort of jaw-drop of outcry of these behind-the-scenes stories of some of the things that happened that involved exploitation of children. That factors very heavily into the project that you and I worked on late last year with a film crew from New York. And
we're not purposely being vague. We have to be vague.
They've asked us to be.
We're not allowed to divulge a whole lot of information about that just yet. So believe you,
when it's
time to talk about it, we will.
What we can say is that Saint and I were involved in a documentary about the history of online predation, and they were interested in talking to us because of the work we did with Perverted Justice and Dateline. And that's about the extent to what we can say. That's all true, and it doesn't divulge anything. It doesn't betray any confidences, but it's something that we're very excited about, but also sort of very reserved about for the same reasons that you were just talking about. Like, you know, you watch this, a lot of TV you watch because it's enjoyable, and a lot of TV you watch because it's important. This falls into the second category. And I think once, just based on what we know of what the folks that we worked with have told us about what their goals are, and what the story is that they're telling with this documentary, ours is probably going to be mentioned in the same breath with it as Quiet on Set. Yeah.
I hope so.
Ours
and
will
not
probably
just because
be bucketed in the same general overall area.
Not just for self-aggrandizement. I could care less. Yeah. I think the topic matter is super important. I think it's something that needs to get widespread. Because of the fact of the matter is we have too many parents out there who take a hands-off approach to their children. Oh, I want my kid
gentle
to like
parenting.
Me. I want my kid to be my friend. I want to be their friend. I want them to be able to come to me. There, you need to be a parent. And here's the issue that we run across is that's what's happened on these Hollywood sets. And again, we talk about the fact that we don't always have all of the answers, but in this particular case, the answers aren't that complicated. These kids are being brought into a situation where they are being put to work as actors, paid as actors, given money, given a lifestyle, given, you know, adult issues at a very young age.
Ushered into a world that even a lot of adults have a hard time dealing with.
Absolutely. And so we see things like, you know, Jake Lloyd, who was Anakin Skywalker early in his career. And then, like, drummed out of acting by the time he was, like, 14. And it took a very serious, heavy mental toll on him. Eddie Furlong, driven out of acting and had become dependent on drugs and alcohol and almost ruined his life. Things like that. Drew Barrymore, thankfully, came out the other side pretty pristine. But the fact of the matter is we don't have any protections in place for these kids. And what they're saying is protections is lip service. These kids need to be treated like a valued commodity because they are a commodity on these sets. You need them there. You can't do this without them. So start treating them better. Pay them what they're worth. Have a union set up to protect these children specifically. And we're not talking about like the Screen Actors Guild. We're not talking about the Writers Guild. We're talking about a separate child acting union, and maybe one already exists. I don't know. I haven't done the research on whether or not that's a thing yet.
But the less we focus on that, the more we wind up with Corey Haim or Jonathan Brandis or Brittany Murphy
or
David Plato or Gary Coleman or any of these incredibly troubled performers, Heath Ledger even, who were actors when they were kids and then just got sick as they got older and either succumbed to depression or addiction or self-harm in some other way. There are just so many. Unfortunately, for every Kurt Russell or every Neil Patrick Harris that we got to keep and who seems to make it into adulthood, if not unscathed, at least whole and functioning, there are just dozens. Dozens of kids who just were chewed up by the system and spit out and either are bitter and struggling or who just aren't around anymore.
Right. And so we need to have safeguards put in place for these children. Education, yes. We know that they need to be educated, yes. But we need to have parent advocacy groups with parents on these sets actively involved in the writer's room, actively involved in, you know, behind the scenes activities. especially as it revolves around their children. An active monitor on these kids at all times. And yes, people are going to say, that's stifling. Oh my God, they don't need to be there all the time. God, why does my mom have to always be involved? Oh, I hate my mom. She's always behind the scenes keeping an eye on me. She never lets me be an adult. Good. Yeah. It falls under the same damn category we talk about with gentle parenting. You need to be the parent.
Let me tell you something.
To be there.
I was not involved in show business when I was a kid. I did, you know, I acted in school and had aspirations of maybe someday heading out to Hollywood. And when I eventually did it, it was as a writer and not as an actor. But I consider myself an actor when I was a kid. And I definitely thought about it. But nonetheless, it wasn't something that I ever pursued seriously. But I did, to a certain extent, have, if not strict, if not helicopter, at least involved parents. My dad was a sheriff's deputy in a very small rural county, in the sort of pre-meathead, pre-militant, pre-horrible era of law enforcement that he'd be horrified if we had now. My dad, I mean, obviously you have to acknowledge the fact that law enforcement was always kind of in service of a very flawed and underlying, inherently racist system, but I grew up with my dad and his friends that he worked with on the sheriff's department as very much being the protect and serve kind of guys. If anybody stepped an inch out of line, they got rid of them. They drummed them out. It, you know, these were the best cops you could hope to have. It's just really the point of that. But because I grew up in a very small town with a cop for a dad, he had a uniform network of spies all over the county. I couldn't get away with shit, and so I didn't try. I was not only a cop's kid, but I was also a big kid. I was a 6-foot-tall 10-year-old, so it was kind of drilled into me from a very early age that that good boy syndrome was probably going to be the way to go for me. And so I did that. And my parents were very involved. They, in an era even before digital, they kept a close eye on me. They gave me some very serious guidelines for how I was to conduct myself and how I, you know, come home and behave yourself. And it wasn't because... I don't resent them for that. Even at the time, I remember thinking, well, my dad knows better than most. He's a cop. He sees what goes on. He sees people on their worst days. He sees people who have committed crimes, people who are victims, people who are hurting, car accidents. He sees all of that, and he's just trying to protect me. But I really, in my adulthood, look back on that and go, yeah, maybe I couldn't go and tear ass around the back 40 on a four-wheeler like a lot of my friends did. Maybe I didn't get invited to the parties where a lot of these kids were drinking themselves into a stupor and passing out at 15 years old. And that's fine. As an adult, I look back on that, and even at the time, I wasn't really necessarily interested in a lot of that. But I describe my childhood now as being idyllic. I grew up in fucking Mayberry, and I was safe, and I was loved,
right,
and I never had to fear for anything. Because I knew that even in the instances where my parents weren't around to watch over me, they had instilled in me enough common sense to the point where I knew how to stay out of situations that might turn out to be dangerous. And I'm not going to victim blame. Nobody can completely steer clear of being victimized if somebody's truly out to get them. But there are certainly ways you can navigate through life where you can safeguard yourself against deliberately putting yourself in harm's way or putting yourself in a compromising position that might result in bad things happening to you. You can't prevent everything, but you can be aware. And I was. And so I emerged into adulthood as somebody who was not abused, who was not victimized. I got bullied once in a while, sure. I mean, no kid really gets through scholastic experiences without suffering some sort of like unpleasantness. But I talk to a lot of my friends, and I understand, in retrospect, just how good my childhood really was. And I acknowledge the privilege of that, because not everybody got to be there.
Right, and so, and that's what we need to make sure we safeguard for these kids as well. Again, we're talking about specifically, in this particular case, yes, in a very broad sense, we're talking about all children, your children, my children, but in specific, we're talking about these children on these Hollywood sets, and what can be done to kind of safeguard them going forward. And again, we don't specify that we have all the answers. No. All we can do is take an active interest. And I think that's what this documentary really puts into play, is it opens up the door to people going, hey, maybe I didn't know about this, or I didn't realize it was this bad, or, oh my God, is this really happening? And the more eyeballs it shines onto this issue, the better, I believe. And and I think that one of the be-all, end-all goals of this documentary and documentaries of its ilk, we'll just say, that may or may not be coming out within the end of the year, we need to say that the the be-all, end-all is these people need to be protected. There has to be some kind of presence on these film sets that keeps these children from going off the rails. And they may hate you for it.
Mm-hmm.
But again, be hated. They may rebel against it. Be there when it fails.
You need better to be you be the hated parent. Than them be victimized. That's really the end all. That's what at the end of the day, that's what it comes down to, really.
Absolutely. I mean, because look at what happened to Macaulay Culkin. How long it took him to write himself, to write his ship after his brush with childhood stardom. Him and his brothers as well. Look at Britney Spears and what it's taken to try and right the ship that she's on. That ship may never fully be righted at this point. There's only so much you can do after the fact. Picking up the pieces is not the time to try and make amends. You want to try and save the breaking before it happens.
Yeah.
Right. So we need to be there. We need to be an active presence on these sets. We need to have, you know, guardians on these sets whose sole position and job is to eyeballs on with these kids at all times to make sure, you know, nefarious shit isn't going on behind the scenes. Nobody's asking for foot rubs or back rubs or this, that, or the other thing. We need a presence in the writer's room to make sure we're not doing, you know, jerk-off jokes with preteens in a Nickelodeon situation. I mean, there's so much that can be done that would really take not a lot of effort.
Yeah.
A little pushback is all it takes. And you may get your Dan Schneiders being up in arms and saying, oh, well, I don't need this, and I don't want this on my set, and if you do this, I'm going to walk and take all of my... Goodbye.
Mm-hmm.
That should be your first sign. You want to talk about a giant glaring red flag? That should be it.
Yeah.
You know, these people should want to keep these kids safe, too. As a commodity, as a human being, they should want to keep these kids safe. And so, again, do we have all the answers? No. We're a fandom-related podcast. We talk about these things because Jim and I have a shared history in protecting children online from child predation. And so this kind of thing hit really close to home for us.
Yeah.
It definitely stirred up a lot of emotions. And I think if you go into this knowing that it's going to be a heavy watch, you should watch it anyway. And so I highly encourage everyone to go out there. Hit up Max if you're a subscriber. If not, I think they do like a free month. You know, just sign up for a month. Dip your toes in. Check this program out. It's worth it. It's definitely, I mean, are they 100% right in all situations? No. I mean, we've seen the Mark Summers fallout from this, you know, misrepresentation of what they were to get information out of someone that maybe didn't have any information to give. But by and large, the topic requires talking about, the topic deserves talking about. And I think that's what this documentary does a really good job of. So step outside of your comfort zone and take a look at, if you've not seen it already, Quiet on Set. It's 5 episodes. Each episode's about 35, 40 minutes long, give or take, something like that. And it's a worthwhile endeavor. And definitely let us know what you think the answer to this is, too. What kind of parenting style do you take with your children, if any? You know, are you their parent? Are you their friend? Are you their some kind of cross in between? Am I wrong? Am I right? I'd like to know. Because if there's something that I can be doing better, I don't mind admitting that I'm wrong. In this particular case, education is key. You don't know what you don't know. And if you can better your approach based on advice from other people, I'm more than happy to do that. I don't have enough ego embedded in this. It's all about taking care of my kids. And so I highly encourage everyone to go out and to check out this documentary and keep an open mind while you watch it and see what you would come up with. What would you do if it was your child in this particular situation? How would you react? Because at certain points of watching this, I definitely had the reaction of, well, I would storm down on that set and light it on fire.
Mm-hmm.
I would find Dan Schneider's trailer, dump gasoline on the top of it, and light a match. I mean, that might be a little reactionary, you know. But, you know.
That might get you banned from Facebook or Twitter if you actually tried to write that out. But, you know, it's hard not to feel that way.
But let us know. We definitely want to know your take on this. Have you watched Quiet on Set? Have you watched... Do you have any experience with these Nickelodeon shows as a whole? Or child acting as a whole? We want to kind of know where you feel, where you sit on this. We want to know your opinions of it. Again, it's not something we relish talking about because it's a super heavy topic. And, I mean, it's hard. It's not an easy topic, but it's worthwhile. So we want to know what your thoughts are on that. Hit us up, facebook.com/fuelyourfandom. Drop us a line, fuelyourfandom@gmail.com.
FYFTalentBooking@gmail.com, @FuelYourFandom on Instagram and Threads. And, of course, you can find us anywhere fine podcasts are found, especially at FuelYourFandom.Buzzsprout.com.
Definitely let us know your thought process on this. Not a lot of funny jokes in this one. Certainly not the normal routine. And we'll get back to lighthearted shit next week. But I didn't want too many weeks to go by after this program ended without us at least addressing the 400-pound elephant sitting in the refrigerator. How did it get its feet in the cheesecake?
But you gotta wonder.
But from us to you, we want to thank you for listening to another episode of the Fuel Your Fandom podcast. We do appreciate it, and we appreciate you. And please do remember that everything is fandom, and fandom is everything. Take care.
Setting.
Ladies, please. All our founding fathers, astronauts, and World Series heroes have been either drunk or on cocaine.